And some of the wholesalers I'm actually the most impressed with are not the guys that do the most deals. They're not necessarily the smartest guys. It's just the guys that take action. So you might have some new wholesaler who has no idea what they're doing with numbers, no idea how to negotiate, right. Quite frankly, no idea about too much because all their training is YouTube, but they still are able to get a deal closed just because what they are doing is the thing that matters most, and that's their doing.
All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Atlanta Real Estate Investor Podcast. I am your host, Spencer Sutton, and I have got a great guest today. I think everybody's going to enjoy meeting Frank Iglesias. Frank, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Spencer. Appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Yeah, no, we're excited about it. I'm excited to learn from you, to hear what you've been doing. Now, Frank is the founder of He's got a few businesses, but I'll just give you a couple of them. One of them is called Working with Houses, and this is his business that is actively buying properties, buying and selling properties in the Atlanta area. And then he has another company called Skywalk Homes, and this is related to what you were telling me, Frank, is new construction deals. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's where we publicly market our new builds and also our remodels as well.
Great, great. Well, let's get in. I mean, I always love to hear how people got into real estate because there's a lot of different paths, a lot of different ways people get into real estate. So I'd love to hear, Frank, you tell your story. Why real estate? How did you get in it? What's your story? And then how long have you been doing it?
Sure. So many years ago, I was an IT professional for 15 years. I had a great run in that industry. Met a lot of great people, learned a lot of great things. We did both corporate work and consulting work. And yeah, the consulting work was maybe some of the most fun because you got to get out and meet other people. And when you consulted, you were like the guy. So there was, which, you know, that carried its own stereotypes sometimes in some organizations, but somewhere in the middle of that, and really, it goes back. I couldn't even tell you how many years. I remember when I was young, my uncle had an interest in real estate that I heard about. And I was probably a teenager or young adult when I was hearing this. And it was a long time ago. So it was just sort of an idea back then, but it sounded cool. Fast forward several years, my business partner, she started tinkering around with things. And she started working after she graduated. She started working with apartment complexes, just working with renting, leasing, all, you know, all the stuff goes along with that world. And then she bought her first home, which was a foreclosure, and they fixed it up. And they just fixed it for themselves. And, but, you know, that was sort of maybe the first dabble into it. And then somewhere around the time that was going on, I heard about a Rich Dad, Poor Dad seminar. To this day, I don't remember how I found out about that or learned it.
And when is this?
Who knows? Like
what year is this?
This is back in 2008.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, so right in the best time to get into real estate.
Yeah, so summer of 08, I go to this 2 or 3 hour thing. And I was, and you know, of course, like it's designed to do, it gets the brain turning and you're like, right. I've never heard any of this before. This is very fascinating. So it sounded very compelling. Long story short, we drank the Kool-Aid, did 3 Rich Dad classes, which were very helpful. I mean, in retrospect, you know, were they the best value? I don't know if they were, but they were good enough because they got us going. So it did the job.
Yeah. They laid the foundation.
It laid a foundation. We bought our first property January of 2009. And to this day, we still own it.
So great. It's awesome.
I call it the rehab we have never finished, and we still haven't finished it.
Now, is it a rental? Is it a rental for you? Gotcha.
Yeah. So obviously a much better equity position today than 12 years ago, but a good house. And I was still working IT. And then I was introduced to wholesaling probably in 2010-ish. And so that was interesting. But I think what really got me to really start thinking about the transition was, there's a gentleman out of Tampa, Lee Kearney, who I can never give enough credit to, incredibly smart guy. He had a course called REO Rockstar, and I took that, and I was like, you know, the whole idea was, you know, buy and flip bank-owned properties, wholesale them.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, I marvel at it even more now that how successful he was at it, because thinking about how easy it was to get REOs, and sure, yet he was still wholesaling. I was like, man, that's pretty remarkable the more I think about it. And, but I think that was the one that really got us thinking, hey, we could really do this and just do real estate. Coincidentally, and again, none of this was planned, it was coincidental, my corporate world job was going really well. I had a great team, great company, great manager. I mean, everything was great. You can add, the pay was great. Everything was great.
Right.
But I was bored. So I'll never forget, when I left IT, I told my manager, I said, you know, I'm not leaving the company, I'm leaving IT. So I'm just bored. Just bored. We were very good at what we did. It was a very good team, really great group of people. I mean, couldn't really ask for more. And I'm like, well, you know, if all of this is this good and you're bored, that was a sign.
Yeah.
So in July 2011, we left and we began the crash course of entrepreneurship. So
yeah, that is a crash course.
Yeah, it took about 6 months just to actually realize what I just decided. But yeah, you know, it took some time. But we did a lot of wholesaling after that, and then we always did a few flips. And then we took a deeper dive in the new construction and huge projects. That was back 2014, 2015. And, you know, now we've done all these things quite a bit. And what we really decide is what we enjoy the most is actually the wholesale deals, the rentals, because you get paid a lot sooner. And we're still okay with flips. We're still okay with new construction, but really not trying to go crazy with that stuff.
Right.
Because it is very resource intensive.
It is. Yeah. Resource intensive, time intensive, capital intensive. I mean, it just takes more of your time and energy as well as your money. So talk about, I want to go back a little bit. There is this kind of thought, because a lot of people do get bored in their work. They do kind of reach a point where they're like, you know what? I don't want to necessarily work in corporate world for the rest of my life. I've started buying some rentals. I've started doing this. I really want to make that transition. Tell me about the mindset. Like, how did you make that decision? Did you say, hey, I want to get up to a certain amount of income in the bank, or I want to have 6 months of runway in the bank? Or like, what was your mindset? What were some of the fears, some of the things that you had to think through and wrestle through before you actually turned in your notice and left a very comfortable, well-paying job?
You know, of course, as I mentioned, I was bored with the work. I would say the last, I remember one of the things I said to my manager was, hey, you know, when I started IT, Windows 95 was still cool. Okay, remember that back that far.
Yeah, I do.
So, you know, when I started IT, Windows 98 was like coming soon, but it wasn't out yet. So, and back then you had to know how computers work, like physically, how did they work and what parts, and you didn't have to be a coder, but you had to know some basic understanding of why computers operate the way they do. By the time I left, you didn't have to know any of that anymore. Like today, most people were, I don't want to say most, but like if you're coming into IT today, you don't have to know how a computer works.
Right.
You know, it's so well tuned. It's like a light switch. You don't have to know how a light switch works. You just know it does.
Right.
Because it's so well tuned. But that wasn't the case in the late 90s. You still had to know how these things work if you were going to be a professional in IT. And I was in the infrastructure side. You know, I wasn't a coder or a developer. And so by the time I left, everything was becoming automation driven.
Right.
The idea of the cloud, you know, the cloud today is just, you know, everyone knows what the cloud is.
Right.
But in 2011, the cloud was like our IT group, we would almost mock people for fun. Like, oh my gosh, they're going to sell us on the cloud. Because it was like a marketing buzzword, but nobody really understood it. You know, it wasn't mainstream.
Sure. People didn't trust it.
They didn't trust it. You know, it just wasn't quite proven. This idea of software as a service was still very new. Because, you know, back then it was download everything to your desktop computer because that's just what you did.
Right.
And now you're saying you want me to release that control. But even in the midst of all that, I would say, you know, technology, this is 2011, technology is so powerful now that we all have a supercomputer in our pocket. We just call it an iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're talking an iPhone, whatever it was then, a 3GS or something like that. Nothing yeah. like what it is today.
Right.
And so in the midst of all of that, it just felt like the challenge was no longer there. And so it just, you know, we were very good. We had a joke internally. So if we get any better at this, we're going to automate ourselves out of a job.
Right.
And there was an element of not necessarily truth to the position, but truth to the emotion
mm-hmm.
of, man, you just, because so many things are automated, it's, what are we going to do next?
Right.
You know, that kind of thing. So that was a real emotion. So there was also an element, I guess, if I was looking for a new challenge, one that also had more, obviously, when you're in a job, you know, there's a ceiling to what you can do unless you transfer somewhere else in the company
right.
or your boss steps away. So whereas with investing, it was like, well, there is no ceiling except the ones we impose on ourselves.
Yeah, you're the ceiling at that point.
Correct. And I think most investors will tell you, and I'll be the first to tell you, that we all have PhDs at putting ceilings on ourselves.
True. Yeah, there's no doubt.
So we have to learn how to reconfigure our own minds to get past that. And that's, quite frankly, that's probably been the hardest challenge.
Was there a fear going from your corporate job to, hey, I'm going full-time into this?
Not really, because I didn't know enough to be scared.
Gotcha. Yeah.
It's just what you just don't know what you don't know. Maybe there should have been.
It's good. Good. You know, when I started, when I left my job, this was 2004, into 2003, 2004. I didn't know enough to know what to be scared of. And we had actually bought a HomeVestor franchise. So we were like, hey, we've got money to dump into this marketing machine back in those days, and they will produce leads. We just needed to trust the system, and it worked out fine. So that's good to hear.
Well, and that's those words, trust the system. That was probably one of the hardest lessons.
Yeah.
It was just trusting. And I think most people dabble too much. And now from a coaching perspective, the number one thing I see is people taking tiny amounts of action yet expecting massive results.
So what do you mean by that? I mean, when you see people just kind of timidly like trying one little thing over here and doing maybe putting their toe in the water, and then they're like, well, that didn't really work, and then they go try to do something else. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly it. So I'll give you two contrasting positions. One is most people, what they'll do is they'll try, because again, it's the fear of losing money, the fear of losing the deal, the fear of just losing, fear of losing, fill in the blank.
Right. Right.
And so, hey, let's try a marketing campaign, a very, very common example. So I'm going to do direct mail, or maybe I'll cold call or whatever technique you want to use. And I'll do a list of maybe 300, 400, 500. And I'll do it one time, maybe twice, because I'm ambitious, and they don't get a result. And so, well, I guess that doesn't work. Or maybe they still want to believe it works, but now they're even more afraid of it because they did it once or twice and it still didn't produce a result. And so that's a very common thing people get hung up on. They just don't take enough action. But on the flip side, you'll sometimes get wholesalers. You know, wholesalers, as you know, get a bad rap by a lot of people. But the reality is some of them do a good job. And some of the wholesalers I'm actually the most impressed with are not the guys that do the most deals. They're not necessarily the smartest guys. It's just the guys that take action. So you might have some new wholesaler who has no idea what they're doing with numbers, no idea how to negotiate, quite frankly, no idea about too much because all their training is YouTube.
Right.
But they still are able to get a deal closed just because what they are doing is the thing that matters most. And that's their doing. They're taking the action.
They're taking action. Right.
I saw a cool, you know, we're going through a little bit of a Grant Cardone training now in the world of sales with my team. And he says it right there. The most important word in sales is do. That's it. D-O, do. And so I love seeing wholesalers, really just investors in general, that they do. And if they mess up, that, you know, they don't, I mean, they might get a little bent out of shape about it, but at the end of the day, they're doing it. And I make sure I tell them, I'm like, look, the fact that you just did it is fantastic.
Yeah.
Because for everyone that does, there's plenty that don't.
That's right. There's definitely more that don't.
10 to 1, I would say. Yeah. 10 to 1. I run a wholesale meeting, and we've tracked all the people who have come to our meetings over, we're going on 8 years now. And 90% of them are no longer involved. So if I meet 10 wholesalers, I know, better the numbers, 1 in 10 will stick around for a while.
So this is a huge lesson. I think this is great for anybody who's listening, and it really applies to all aspects. If you're in flip business, if you're looking for rentals, or if you're trying to wholesale, I mean, really learning with a bias for action, like you have to be willing to actually, you know, just what Frank is saying, do, because a lot of times we just want to gather so much information that it paralyzes us and we aren't able to make a decision and we don't take the next step. And so I like to say information without implementation is just another form of sedation, right? So we can just sedate and think we're doing something, but in reality, we're not really doing anything at all. Like we think, hey, if I go to a year's worth of meetings with Frank and learn more about wholesaling, that I'm going to be a wholesaler, but it's really the people who take action. And you learn from taking action. I mean, that is, you mentioned a PhD earlier. I mean, you get some good lessons from a trial and error out there.
Yeah. And one of the biggest lessons I learned early on, and I've never forgotten it, was since I heard someone say, if you're not making offers, you're not doing anything.
Yeah.
So you see, there's plenty of reels, and you know the courses out there. And by the way, it's all good information, but that's all is information. Get your website, get your business card, get your social media profile, you know, build your team. I was just on a Clubhouse call last night, and literally the guy was a real nice guy. He's like, well, you know, the market, and he's up in D.C. He's like, you know, the D.C. market is just, it's super competitive and it's expensive, da, 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 da. And so I'm just thinking of holding back and building my team up more. What do you think? I said, I would throw everything you just said away. I said, yeah, I say, right. You need to do.
Yeah.
And I said, what you need to become is a master of acquisitions. Because if you can acquire, you can do everything else. That's but right. he didn't have the understanding of how to be good at acquisitions. So it's not about being a wholesaler, a rehab, or a builder, or a landlord. It's about acquisitions.
Right.
And the better you are at that, then the better you can be at the exit strategies.
Exactly.
But that was a great example. And so I coached him on that. And I said, but, you know, that's a great picture of what commonly happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's low inventory. Let me go build my team. Let me go get the business. You know, you just, you know, you don't need business cards. You need to make offers, make offers, make offers, make
that's
offers.
Right. That's right.
If you're not making offers. And that statement has become really true. When you make offers, momentum happens.
That's right. It does.
Yeah. You might make too many offers and get too many yeses and create problems for yourself, but those are way better problems than...
I would rather have a deal under contract and then have to figure out what to do with it than not have a deal under contract, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's really what we come across now is I find now that it's not hard to get a lot of deals under contract. What's hard is going through all the extra steps to get them to closing.
Yeah, right.
Because there's just so many little things that come up along the way that... you know, may or may not be within your control.
Sure.
The seller this, the attorney that. I have one right now where the surveyor, the legal description doesn't match the site plan. And right now closing's delayed. And it's a minor issue, but instead of closing last Friday, now we're hoping to close, we're not a week from, but maybe this coming Monday.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting. I mean, I think you bring up a great point, Frank, and that is that we can so easily get in the trap of convincing ourselves we're making progress when we're really not making progress at all, right? So we can convince ourselves that ordering the business cards is exactly what we need to do, because then in our mind we think, because I need to have something to hand somebody when I meet them at their house or I meet them at their property. And that's not really moving you towards making an acquisition. So we convince ourselves that all these little things, these activities that we're doing are actually making progress, but they're not making progress at all. So I think that's a great point. Like, take action. So Frank, tell us a little bit about when you're looking for properties. I mean, do you have a specific area of Atlanta that you love to invest in or that you see as up and coming? And then what is a good deal to you? Like, what is your, do you have a buy box? I mean, I know that most of the time you're not holding on to them. You're doing wholesale deals, but what does that look like?
So, yeah. So the first part is with regards to our primary market being Atlanta, you know, we've done deals in, I like to say, all four quadrants, you know, yeah, Northeast, Northwest, and so forth. It's twofold. In an ideal world, most of the deals I do would be close to home. Okay, that's everyone's ideal world.
Right.
But the reality is the majority of deals done are closer to the city because that's really where the lower hanging fruit is.
Gotcha.
There's just more opportunities there. It's more densely populated. There's more beat up properties. There's more sellers to order. There's just more.
Gotcha.
So it's a mix. We always want to do stuff closer to home, but the reality is ultimately we'll go to where the deal is.
Right.
Where we want to go is where all the buyers are.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you, I guess you've built up a buyer's list for pretty much any area in Atlanta that you want to purchase in, but you definitely know who they are for the most part.
Yeah. By and large, we know who a lot of the very legit buyers are that we've sold to over the years. And there's always new buyers coming in as well. So it's a never ending process. You know, right now we have a campaign going where we're really networking heavy with agents. And so here's an example of an action task. Now, this is something that one of my assistants did. And we said, we want to target all the agents. And here's a just free marketing tip for everyone listening. I want to target all the agents that were involved in an all cash transaction below a price point. Let's say 200,000. I'll just pick a number. I want to talk to every buyer's agent and listing agent on that transaction. And we want to just simply be a resource for them. Hey, can you add us? There's two reasons we're contacting you. One, hey, if you come across a property that needs a buyer, we'd love to take a look. We don't even have to be your primary buyer because some of these people already have lists. We just want to be right. An additional resource to have in your back pocket. If your main person says no or group, no problem, send it to us. Maybe we'll say yes. And then by the same token, hey, when we get off-market properties, if you have buyers, we'd like to just present them to you. You get paid your full commission. And hey, we can do business that way. And so we called my assistant. It took her about a month to do it. But she did a few hours every day. Called something like 2,755 agents, I think was
it. Oh, my goodness.
2,755 agents. Of that, and I don't have it in front of me, but about 40%, 30 to 40%, somewhere in there, answered the phone. Mm-hmm. And or called back, texted. So now think about that. Over half, we still haven't even spoken with.
Right.
Which that screams a lot about communication, how it could be improved. But of that roughly 30 or 40% that answered the phone, we came up with a list of, I want to say it's just under 700 agents that are now on our list to communicate with.
Wow.
Now, that is a list of agents that I can present a new deal to at any given moment,
mm-hmm.
that we get a deal, and that we can constantly tell them, hey, we're still here. Just kind of keep us in mind. And the other thing we're going to do is we're going to provide them a value add. Hey, here's a resource we have. If it can help you with, you know, your world doing the agent thing, great. You know, use this person, use this, you know, because that agents are always looking for this. What are they always looking for? Who's a good mortgage broker? Who's a good contractor? Yeah, who's a good inspector? They're always, just like we shuffle and are always looking for new buyers as people come in and out. It's the same thing with that.
No, I think that's a great marketing tip. I think for anybody listening, I mean, we had a gentleman on the show, our Birmingham show, named Matthew Gregory. And I was asking him, how are you finding deals? Because he did 90 deals last year, 90 flips. So these are flips, not wholesales. I asked him, how did you find so many deals? And he said, I haven't spent a dollar on marketing. It is literally, I have built relationships with realtors over the years, just realtors, they know who they can call. They know who will buy their house. And that's in a small market like Birmingham. Just imagine Atlanta. There's so many more realtors and so many more opportunities. So I think that's a great action tip somebody can take.
Well, just FYI, we're also in a secondary market and we're executing this now and there.
Mm.
A little bit smaller than Birmingham. It's a town of a couple hundred thousand people.
Yeah.
But here's the cool thing, less competition.
That's right.
Atlanta's hyper competitive. Secondary market, not quite as much.
Yeah.
And one thing I learned in this particular market is no shortage of opportunity.
Yeah.
There's no shortage. And so there's deals everywhere. And you're right. It does. I mean, what did it cost me? At the end of the day, it just cost me. For me, it was paying my assistant to make 2,000 plus, almost, 2,700 phone calls.
Yeah.
Just a little each time. But I mean, if I close just one deal with one agent, and let's say it's just a simple $5,000-$10,000 wholesale flip. I mean, I've covered my assistant's calls, 10 times over.
Yeah. 100%. And I think the going back to what you were saying earlier, Frank, about the people that you see that often don't find success and don't stick with it, you know, the temptation would be for somebody to say, well, I called 50 realtors and 45 of them didn't pick up their phone and 5 of them said they weren't interested. This isn't working. Right. And they're done at 50, as opposed to saying, I'm going to go for 500. Like, I'm going to give it my all at 500. I think that's a good number to start with. So,
and you track the math again.
That's right.
Again, approximately 60% of these people, we're going to have to do another round. The search party's still out. You know, we haven't found.
Yeah, them. That's right. That's right. Hopefully, they're still in the business.
Well, that's true. And you know, to that point, we actually called our entire buyers list. And what we learned was two things. One, approximately 40%, give or take, picked up the phone, mm-hmm. text, whatever. So then the majority we're still looking for.
Right.
And here was the interesting. Of the 40% that answered the phone, 80% of them were no longer in real estate.
Wow. Did you get any kind of data on why they were out of real estate? I'm sure there's a number of reasons, but anything stick out to you in those conversations?
Yeah. Number one reason, too hard to get a deal, too time consuming, too competitive, not enough money. The same things you hear from the people that are in it.
Yeah. But they're still in it.
Yeah. Yeah. There was no revolutionary reasons the people that were no longer in it shared.
Right. Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah. But that was, I did not, it's, I figured, I guess, man, maybe half, give or take, but 80%. And so I said, well, that explains why the open rate's really low.
Yeah, that's right. Emails, that's right.
We don't wonder that anymore. We know exactly why that open rate is low.
That's right. They're not in the business anymore. Well, you know, something I noticed as I was doing some research and reading about you, Frank, is, I mean, obviously you're a very successful real estate investor. You're finding deals in this very competitive market. I mean, you are battling for deals with a lot of other investors, plus institutions that are obviously in Atlanta looking for these deals, but you're also very passionate about helping people and coaching people. And you mentioned earlier, hey, I've got this wholesale group that meets and had been meeting for several years. Why are you passionate about, why do you look to help other investors? Can you tell me a little bit about like what's driving that and what that even looks like?
Yeah, I used to teach before I got in real estate. Even when I was fresh out of high school, my high school music teacher asked me to come back and help assist him teach some of the other kids in the band program. I was a percussionist. And so ever since I was 18, I've been asked to help. And so, you know, and I was actually a music major in school. And so while I was doing IT, I also taught music for 15 years as well. So I actually started teaching music before I was even in IT. I've always been around that education space. My wife also is a music major. She got her master's and so forth. And she had an education degree. She actually did work in the schools for 3 years before her first child was born. And then my mother-in-law has also been a music educator. My father-in-law's, you know, he was an educator, not in music, but in math. And so there's a lot of education running around here.
Yeah, it's in your blood.
So it's something, it's just been a really just a natural outlet to help others. And that's where I can do it best. And, you know, back in music, I called it teaching. When I was in IT, I mentioned earlier, I really enjoyed the consulting because when you consult, you're educating.
Yeah.
And yeah, they're looking at you like, you know, the big guns, so to speak. But that was really what made that fun was you got to travel to places and you got to educate. You solved their problem and you educated them. So it was very fulfilling. I always said if I ever did IT again, I would want to be a consultant. Mm-hmm. Because that was where you really got to be a big value add to people. And so now in real estate, you know, we don't call it consulting, we call it coaching or mentoring. It's the same thing. And so what I do today is, you know, I have a few coaching clients. You know, it's a side thing I do. It's not my primary business, but I'll coach people one-on-one. I've thought about maybe opening up a group coaching type thing, just to, you know, be able to help more people. But at the end of the day, I'm first and foremost, we're an active investor because I don't ever want to be that person that says, that's like, oh, he does all this education, but he doesn't even do deals. You know, you've heard that out there, which is true.
Yeah, right. Those who can't do teach is, I think, is what people have said in the past, right?
Yeah. So we teach, but we do.
Yeah. Those are the best teachers.
Yeah. And I always tell people, so I love coaching them. And I always tell them, hey, when you find a coach, don't just find someone who's uber successful, find someone who's also been an uber failure.
Yeah.
Because when you run into a hard time, if they've never failed, how are they going to help you if they've never walked through the fire themselves?
Right.
I didn't learn that in real estate, by the way. I learned that from my business coach. And what I've learned was it was very fascinating to go to an event where there was a lot of ultra successful people. And the common thread I heard from all these uber successful people was before they were uber successful, they had to go through a very dark period. And they're glad they did because now they could appreciate what they had. So, you know, and we've been through some very challenging time. So at the beginning of it, you know, it's like, oh my gosh, the sky is falling. And it feels like the sky is falling.
Sure.
But when you're getting toward the tail end of it, you're like, okay, we're going to be fine. There's a few bumps, a few headaches, but now the scary monster, you realize that idea of fear was a false evidence appearing real. The acronym.
Right. That's right. Yep.
Has a whole new meaning. And you realize that those last two words, appearing real, those are two very big words and they can be two very scary words.
Right.
So, but the reality is, you know, there's far worse problems in the world than a real estate transaction.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that's so true. I mean, we have another podcast that it's called 300 to 3000 and we're talking to property management companies, like we're talking to owners and leaders and property management companies, And I mean, one of the things that we can definitely say is, hey, we have been through, you know, since 2008 when we started, we have been through a lot of challenges, a lot of setbacks, a lot of failures, a lot of things didn't work. And those are some of the best things to share is like, hey, here's what you can avoid, like take our advice. And you're right. You do think that it's the end of the world in some instances, some respects, but ultimately it gives you the opportunity to become stronger, to course correct, to overcome obstacles. And you really, you know, you develop grit and you develop perseverance when you just keep going and don't ever stop. So,
well, you know, what's interesting is I've heard, you know, obviously when somebody has success, we want to celebrate that. Yeah. But let's face it, you know, when people post, hey, I did this, hey, I did this, and I made money, I did this. I mean, it's only exciting for so long. Right. It's only, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, it's the same message over and over. And it's a good message. There's nothing wrong with it. Mm-hmm. But the stories that truly inspire us are when we, and I just think it's human nature, when we see that person that appeared down and out. They appeared like, oh, there's no way they're going to solve that. Or they can't overcome it. Oh, all these people are upset with yeah, whatever, fill in the blank. Yeah. And, but they made it through. You know, those I think are the stories that are ultimately the most inspiring. You know, they went through the challenges. You know, one of my favorite people is, you know, a Michael Jordan, for example. Mm-hmm. And everybody remembers, you know, 6 titles in 8 years and all that. And, you know, greatest athlete and so on and so forth. And while all that is, in my opinion, true, the most fascinating parts of the documentary sometimes are the years before he even won the first one, especially those 100%. the last two before the first one, when they were playing Detroit and they got kicked, they lost, was 89 and 90, I think it was.
Yeah.
And they lost. It's like, man, you were at the finish line, not once, but twice. And you didn't close the deal.
Yeah.
You, your team, your coach, you know, at the end of the day, you didn't close the deal. Yet you were still like the number one athlete, regarded as number one, but you couldn't close the deal. But in 91, he finally did.
That's right.
And then he just, and then he went on a warpath.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, but that's the real journey. And, you know, that's, mm-hmm. I find those stories are the most motivating because, you know, you just keep on going. You keep on
going. No, I think that's a great analogy there, just because you saw Michael Jordan just get so beat down, but he never gave up. I mean, that's the thing. He never gave up. He just kept going. He kept going and he used those losses to fuel him to go win. And then even when he retired the first time and came back like 3/4 of the way through the season, he lost in the finals or not. He lost in the playoffs to Orlando and that fueled him to dig deeper. And he came back and won 3 more in a row. So Absolutely. We love the underdog story. I mean, we really do. So even the greatest athlete in the world can sometimes be an underdog and we want to cheer for him to win.
And you know, what's interesting. You mentioned, and I didn't even think of this till you just said it. The 2 years before he won the first one, not only did he not use the word, you know, he got beat up. Well, he was physically beat up. And I was like, man, that's a good analogy. It's like the closer you get to the first one, that first true pinnacle, man, everybody was beating him up. He had the book written about him. People were physically beating him up.
Yep, that's right.
And he actually realized after the second time it happened, I need to go get physically stronger because these people are physically beating me up.
Yeah, that's right. 100%.
And I'm like, what a great analogy.
The closer you get to breaking through, you're going to meet all kind of resistance. Just know that. There's going to be all kinds of resistance before you finally break through.
That's the truth.
Well, Frank, thanks so much for your time. I mean, this has been great for our listeners. And I just want, I mean, we didn't talk about this before the podcast, but I want to ask you, hey, how can people connect with you? Like, how can our listeners connect with you? Do you have, you know, a place for them to go or email or whatever you want to share?
Sure. We're all over the place. So, our phone number is 678-408-2228. Our email is info@workingwithhouses.com. And of course, we have social media, Facebook and Instagram. in particular is where you'll see me. I'm also on LinkedIn as well. You know, now with the advent of Clubhouse, I've been on Instagram quite a bit more. So that's another thing. We have a show on Wednesday, not a show, but we have a room Wednesday nights from 6 to 8 to 9 o'clock, where it's basically one big free group coaching time of anything related to real estate, but with a focus on construction, rehabbing, new builds, contractors, that sort of thing. Gotcha. So if you're on Clubhouse, you can check me out there. And, you know, it's cool because out of Clubhouse, we've been able to do some personal one-on-one to help some people get through some. In fact, last night, we had our Clubhouse success story where someone met us about a month ago and, you know, they had some challenges and we ended up doing some coaching after that call. And they just shot me a note this past weekend saying it's on the market and they have 4 offers.
Oh, that's already awesome.
And it's their first deal. So they're like, you know.
Oh, yeah. They're thrilled. Super excited. Yeah.
Yeah. So we were just glad. Just, you know, without using Clubhouse, that would never have happened. So that was cool.
Yeah. Very cool. Well, good. Well, this has been a great episode for me. I mean, anytime I get to talk about Michael Jordan with a fellow enthusiast, it's good news. So, but sure. No, thank you. Thank you, Frank, for sharing with us. And hopefully people will reach out to you if they need some help, if they want to be encouraged. And all right, everybody, if you haven't already subscribed to the podcast, please go ahead and do that. You can share this episode with your friends. And I'd love for you to, if you're on, you know, Apple iTunes, I'd love for you to leave us a review if you found value in any of these interviews. That's what we're hoping to do. And so we will see you next week with a new episode of the Atlanta Real Estate Investor.